Welcome to Building Fortunes Radio. Make sure you check us out at buildingfortunesradio.com. Along with our marketing partners, we're here to help our PM Marketing Network Leads customers build their businesses and make the world a better place. At Building Fortunes, we know how much your business means to you and the people important to you. So spread the word, tell a friend, join our newsletter, and go make a difference in your world. Now, on to our show with your host, Peter Mingles.
Hello, everyone. Peter Mingles here. You're listening to Building Fortunes Radio on www.buildingfortunesradio.com. And if you're listening in live, we want to say, first of all, thanks for being here. And if you're listening in live, this is Friday, December 18th. It will be the last Friday show we do live because the next Friday show is going to be Christmas Day and the next one is going to be New Year's Day. And I'm sure a lot of people are probably going to be doing some other things. And if you're listening in, we'll probably do this rebroadcast, so you'll hear this three times if you wanted to. But you want to check out Building Fortunes Radio for a whole bunch of things. We have a lot. We built this platform to be able to help educate people on what's happening in home-based businesses so they can make their own decisions. And a while back, I started doing this show specifically after reaching out to Roger Van Vlissingen. And the reason why I did that is because I am a subscriber to a website called SeekingAlpha.com. And in the pursuit of finding out information relative to what was happening with Herbalife, I discovered that SeekingAlpha.com was a very valuable source for non-Enquirer type information. You know, like there's a lot of TMZ sites out there that sensationalize the stupidity of any industry or any people. But what I found with Seeking Alpha, it was really kind of cerebral. Like there were people there that were smart, I hate to say it. Most people writing on Seeking Alpha know more about MLM than most MLMers know about MLM. So I said, you know, I'm going to reach out to Roger. He writes some interesting articles. Some of them are slanted towards the anti-MLM side. And I'd love to hear his opinion because he is a gentleman who I know can complete his sentences. I can tell he's got a complex brain. He's smart. So I'm going to reach out and see if he'd be interested in, quote-unquote, you know, sharing the stuff that he's got there with the potential of, you know, maybe he thinks he might be ambushed by some stupidity on the, because they do that too in our industry as well. It's no. So the answer is let's get Roger on. Let's talk about some of the things related to MLM and the MLM industry. And he brought along a gentleman named E. Robert Smith. And he asked me if he could be on there. I said, I don't know who E. Robert Smith is. He said, well, he wrote a book called Downline. I said, that sounds like a pretty good book to read. And I said, sure, bring him along. And sometimes when E. Robert Smith is feeling okay or his schedule is appropriate, he'll be there as well. And we've had a couple of other guest speakers too. And then this week we have David Ritchie, who's another gentleman who was introduced to this. And we've had Robert Fitzpatrick on as well. So these are the guys, if you will, including myself, that say, I'm going to throw up the red flags here. We're going to throw up the caution things. We're going to throw up the issues that are really serious issues that need to be addressed if this MLM industry is going to kind of clean its way up for the little guys. So whether the regulators clean it up or we help clean it up, I don't care. I just want MLM, if you will, to be cleaned up. And that means sometimes listening to some of the critics that are here. And some of the critics are, you know, they'll shake their head and they'll say, Peter, I think it's novel but naive what you're thinking because I don't think it could be fixed. I don't think it could be fixed. And there are some days where I nod my head up and down saying, you know what? I'm right there with you. I can see how many people do it the wrong way. And then there's some days where I just say, you know, but when done the right way, the delusion of when done the right way, it still could work. And then we just have to see if there's more than a minority of people that can figure out how to make this thing work. So we do this radio show with the doors wide open, talking about different things and different topics. And I want to introduce two guest speakers today. One is that Roger Van Vlissingen. The other one is David Ritchie. So we'll start off with Roger. You can tell us a little bit about you, and then we'll kick it off by introducing David as well. So first you, Roger. Thanks for being here.
Well, and thanks for having me. This has been a wonderful experience so far. I started looking into MLM around 1990 when I was actually in school and studying economics. And I heard about this stuff. I guess somebody tried to approach me for something. And the more I heard about it, the less I understood it. And I began to look in the literature. And I found precious little solid information. And I believe I stumbled into the name of the well-known Professor Bill Keep from New Jersey. and I found an article or something. But like I say, there wasn't enough there. So I had thought about doing a paper on it, but I never got around to doing that. In any case, as far as MLM is concerned, initially I rejected these deals out of hand, thought they were scams, and then we got to the point where every company that came along was representing that they were not like Amway, and finally I got involved with some, and I found that for the most part they all felt very much the same as Amway, but whatever. In any case, as time went on, I had some interesting experiences, including being involved in a company in about 2003 that after 3 months I pulled out and predicted it was going to get shut down, and within 6 months it did get shut down. So I've seen the good, the bad, and the ugly, and sometimes had fun, but sometimes lost money, and and then recently I began this writing thing because of the Herbalife scenario. And initially I was where you are right now, which is, Peter, I'm saying, is that I thought that MLM could be fixed. As I got deeper and deeper into it, I became more and more convinced that there is something wrong with the model itself, that it cannot be fixed. Yes, you can have direct sales, and yes, you can have levels, because obviously you can build sales teams, and that can be have merit. But the MLM concept is one that is designed for people to lose their money, and the only guys that win are the guys at the top, and it just isn't any good, and I don't think it can be fixed. But that's where I am right now.
Well, we respect your opinion. And then we have David Ritchie. So, David, you came from the perspective of being an outsider looking in and learning about the industry from there, and you have some personal experiences that are certainly worth noting. For those people that are listening in, you want to definitely check out one of David's first radio shows with us where he really kind of tells you a little bit more about his story. But, David Ritchie, thanks for being here.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the good work that you are doing, and Roger and E. Robert as well. My first MLM experience was actually in 1980. I was close to finishing my college degree, and I got a call from my parents. And they said, son, we'd like you to consider dropping out of college and going into business with us. We have an opportunity that is just wonderful. We're going to get free cars. We're going to get free travel. We're going to make a lot of money, and we'd like you to join us. Well, I'd already had enough education to understand that the exponential growth that is the main drawing card to MLM couldn't be sustained. And I just, you know, my education was too important to me to give it up. So I declined their kind invitation. Interestingly, the products from this company were actually pretty good. It was Shackley. And my now ex-wife really had an affinity for them until we divorced. A few years later, she used the products regularly. Cut to 2003, and a good friend of mine from college ended up in a divorce situation, needed some help with her adolescent kids that were completely out of hand, and I ended up moving about 100 miles north from where I was living at the time to help with their kids. Well, over the course of the ensuing months, a romance developed, and I became completely involved in her life, including her professional life. Her goal was to build a successful multi-level marketing business. And I was never really comfortable with what happened, but all the things that I'd been concerned about and more came to fruition, and ultimately our relationship ended, and partly as an indirect result of her involvement. Her son died. And amid all the pain that came with that, came a determination to do something about it. So, beginning in 2012, when I left, I began to intensively research the industry and write about it. So I'm kind of on Roger's side. I think we may differ a little bit in that I'm perfectly happy to excise the fraudulent or deceptive practices from multi-level marketing and let the companies that employ them stand on their own merits. So I've been working on a project that identifies the easiest to discern deception, and we'll soon be submitting an article to the Seeking Alpha that goes into depth on it.
Excellent. Well, thanks for sharing your stories. And, obviously most people know that we build a Building Fortunes radio show, so, I'm an evangelist for home-based businesses. But, however, I'm also a business person, and I think I have a complex enough brain to realize, I want to learn the ropes. I want to learn how these things work. Show me where the potholes are, and that's one of the reasons why we do this show. There's a couple of things that are going on in the industry that are certainly worth noting. So, again, they're worth noting. So if you know where the potholes are, then you know where to avoid the mistakes that other people might have made. And that's somewhat evident relative to some of the cases that are here. And I can guess I could just start with one of them. And I'll start with, I suppose, Vima, since we started with Vima when we first got started. Not a whole bunch is going on with Vima. They were a company that was producing mostly an energy drink, Verve, V-E-R-V-E, if you're looking it up. And Vima is V-E-M-M-A. Vital Essential Minerals, Mangosteen and Aloe, I think, or vitamins rather, Essential Minerals, Mangosteen and Aloe is what Vima would stand for. And by the way, hear a little bit of background noise, so I might have to mute out somebody that might have some background noise. I think that's David. David, I'm going to mute you out, and then I'll bring you back in a second. So back to this, the concept with Vima. Vima was shut down by the FTC temporarily. They had a temporary restraining order, froze their assets. They went to court. Got their lawyers together. They got the restraining order as far as the freezing of everything lifted with conditions that they would have to get the receiver's permission to do or the judge's permission to do lots of things relative to changing around their compensation plan, selling their products and things like that. And we've watched the slow, steady, if you will, transition of Vima going from where they were to now some of the challenges, and we're watching case history as a company is having a chokehold done on them by the government restraints, and whether they're actually going to be able to work their way out of it is going to be a big question mark. But as a result of that, there's been some revelations that they were already in a very weakened position financially. It appears, we don't know all the details, so in the conclusions we draw might be wrong, but it appears that they were in a weakened position, needed cash infusion based on the company owners, and that could happen to any company at any time. So just because it's Vima doesn't mean it couldn't happen with any company, but that does mean that chances are it's even lessening their ability to be strong enough to be able to succumb to the challenges that they faced. So right now there's a little bit of things going on relative to what the company owner, or one of the company owners, BK Barreco, is allowed to do or not allowed to do relative to infusing some cash into a desperate situation. So that's what's happening right now with Vima. And I will open it up to see if Roger wants to add anything to that, or David, I'm going to open up you as well to see if you want to open this up or comment on the Vima situation at all. Go ahead, Roger.
Go ahead, Roger.
Okay. No, I think the Vima situation is extremely educational because I think the FTC has been more clear than it's been in a long time, and they didn't allow BK to do any asset sales because they want to preserve what they've got from the standpoint of recovery. So that places him in a difficult position, but from a standpoint of protecting consumers, it's about the best they can do at this point in time, and they're not letting it slide.
So yeah, so the judge is really taking a hard stance on VEMA. So they are not being nice or lenient. They are really taking a hard stance, and a lot of it has to do with, do you really have real customers, and are you selling your stuff to real customers? And because the government really doesn't, I think if you're reading through things, the government says, we really don't think you do. We have to give you the leeway to be able to try to prove it and see if you can, but we don't think you're going to do it. And because of that, we're not going to give you the leeway that you need to liquidate some of your assets, because these are your assets by name only, but they're going to be our assets to redistribute
yes.
back to the victims is really what I think is happening.
Yep.
Okay, Dave, did you have anything you wanted to add on to that?
Yeah, I think the VEMA solution is perfect. It removes only the most virulent portions of whatever fraud exists and allows the company an opportunity to stand on its own merits. I think that's a worthy pattern going forward. And in addition to that, by relying on an organic change, they're far less vulnerable to appeal with what they've levied against VEMA.
Right, so it's going to be it's certainly a turning point to set the tone for some people. It may not set a precedent, but it certainly sets a tone. Now, the interesting thing, and this is more of a personal interesting thing, a few days before VEMA was shut down, we actually did a radio show for a woman over here in Florida that was setting up an event, like a Super Saturday, as they call them, and she was actually doing VEMA the right way, meaning she was actually not only building a sales team, but she was also selling a lot of product as well, and her mix was right around the proper mix. She probably had 70% of her business coming from people that had nothing to do with the compensation plan. 30% of her income was coming from building a downline as well. And she was a nutritional coach. She was a great example of someone that used the product. And she was the perfect model example. And because successful people do what successful people do, when VEMA went through what she did, she flipped over to a new company, brought her same mentality to it, brought the same work ethic, and is rising up the ranks of that other company as well, selling product to retail people, building a sales organization, still doing everything the right way, and still, of course, doing Super Saturdays. So what a great example. By the way, still hear a little bit of background noise, so if there's any background noise, I think you might have to mute out your mic if you're going to move around. So that was the VEMA
Peter?
Situation. Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is Dave. I'm going to be in my car for a little bit, so if you don't mind
okay.
just muting me out if you hear too much noise, feel free to do so.
Or if you have a mute button on your phone, then just hit the mute button on your phone as well, and then you can control it, if you can. If not, I can mute you out if you're getting any background noise.
Okay.
But I'm gonna mute you out anyway, and then we'll just kind of open up the next topic. So this is for Roger as well. There was another another example of a company being shut down recently, and it was called Team VIN, so TEAMVINH. VINH is the first name of one of the founders or the founder of the company, and it was on a website that I frequent every once in a while, so I always like to give even critics their due because they do provide us information. His name is Patrick Pretty. I say his name because nobody really knows if it's a he. Patrick Pretty is, by his definition, a fake name. So we don't know if it's a guy or a girl, a group of people, but it's probably a guy, I guess, based on the way he writes. So patrickpretty.com is a website that highlighted an SEC case against this gentleman who ran this company called Team VIN. And the most interesting thing about that was the SEC goes after you if you're selling something they call an investment contract or you're not registered to sell a security. Like most of us think of stocks, right? This Security Exchange Commission, most of us think like stocks and publicly traded things, and they go after people that do stuff like that. Most people don't think of MLM like a stock. So if you're in an MLM and then the SEC comes after you, you usually say, well, why in the world is the SEC coming after us? We're not selling stocks. Well, you're selling an investment contract. And there's something called the Howey test, H-O-W-E-Y, and you can go do a search engine search on H-O-W-E-Y and learn what an investment contract is. But they clearly, through their complaint, identified what MLM was. So you can see that the SEC knows what MLM is by their complaint and the definition. But they also went after them for a specific reason. And that specific reason is the idea of the claim that we do all the work for you. we'll help you build your downline. You just put your money in. You kind of sit down, relax, and watch this grow.
Right.
And how many people have ever said anything like that on a conference call? You just get in, I'll build it for you. Or you just get in, we'll build it for you. The company does everything for you. Well, as soon as they're saying that, I know they don't realize this because they're stupid. They don't listen to shows like this. They are just admitting that they are violating the SEC investment contracts because they're not registered with the SEC. So, Roger, I'll let you, and I know you know a lot more about this than I do, but the neat thing about the Team VIN complaint is it really spells that out. So if you're an MLMer and you're reading this, you're like, wow, these are the things that I've heard on the conference calls, and that's where most companies are also falling into some challenges. So that's why I just wanted to bring that up. So, Roger, over to you.
Right. Well, yeah, I think the interesting part that you're kind of hitting on is that, indeed, a lot of MLM people really don't know enough about their industry. And I was involved in MLM off and on for quite a while, but I certainly went to all kinds of conferences, and I got to hear some of the MLM lawyers speak, and I read all the history. So I was really up on it more and more, and the only thing that changed is that over the years my outlook on the situation changed, that I really became extremely critical of it and said it can't be done right. But even while I was in it for a long time, I thought I understood. I thought I understood why some companies were a scam and other companies were not, where some companies were likely to be prosecuted, and periodically I was very right about that. Like I say, when I was involved briefly in this thing called BigSmart in something like 2003 or 2005, I was the one who at a certain point said to my friend, they're not doing such and so very well, and that's going to get them in trouble. And we had a conference call with the owners, and the owners kind of acted like an ostrich, and I was not comfortable. And 6 months later, in fact, the company was shut down by the FTC for the exact reason that I was concerned about. Fortunately for us, by that time, we had long since cleared the field. So it does help if you know a little bit, and saying that, you know, you never know everything, but you learn. And if you're in a business and you're not learning, then there's something wrong there, you know. And that is the unfortunate case with a lot of people who are in MLM. And like right now, people are in MLM completely unaware of what's going on with the FTC and with Herbalife and whatever. They may have heard some of the Herbalife has a problem. Well, the MLM industry has a problem, and that's where we are. So people need to get educated.
Right, so there's, and I'm not an attorney, but there's a couple of prongs, they might call, of the how we test investment contract. So, Roger, I don't know if you know enough about to discuss it, or I could kind of talk about it as well, or maybe we can kind of share.
Well,
this.
You can certainly do it, and I would say the simplest way of looking at it is, like you hinted at before, you know, if you're talking about things like a residual income and like a passive business, then you're immediately in the area of investment and not a business opportunity. But go ahead.
So here's kind of like the way it started, and Howie represents the name of, I think, the people that first, you know, the example, like Charles Ponzi is the example of the Ponzi scheme. Howie has something else to do with it as well. So there's four prongs, and here's the way it started. And I'm giving you the totally inaccurate description, but I'm giving you a thumbnail sketch, so don't worry about the details here. We're just kind of like talking as an example. Give me something simple, Peter, without all the details that I can kind of grasp my mind around. There was a guy, and I'm just saying, you know, using this example, there was a guy that had some land in Florida, and they were going to grow orange trees, and they were going to sell the oranges, and they said to investors, they said, listen, why don't you give me the money, I need some money, and we're going to hire these local people, and we'll give you like a plot of this land or a plot of this little orchard that we're going to grow this oranges on, and you give me like $1,000, and I'm just using the number 1,000, but you give me like $1,000, and based on that money, I think we're going to be able to translate that into X production. So you basically just give us the money, and then we're going to be able to produce the thing, and we'll give you the return. So it's kind of like you get in, we're going to give you the, you know, you, we're going to take your investment, if you will, and then we're going to be able to move forward. So that was an investment contract. And what the definition for an investment contract, and just think about this if you're an MLM, where this might also be similar to what you do. An investment contract under the Howey test is defined as the follows. It's an investment of money due to having an expectation of profits arising from a common enterprise, which depends solely on the efforts of a promoter or a third party. So think this through. An investment of money. So do people buy into a network marketing company? You know, you buy a starter kit? The answer is yes. So you fit on the first prong, let's call it, part of the Howey test, which means you might be in an investment contract. Second one, an expectation of profits arising from. So do you expect profits from that initial investment? The answer is two. So far you fit twice in the qualifications for an investment contract. Third one, in a common enterprise, meaning like a lot of people doing it? The answer is, well, yeah. So three prongs out of the three prongs, which means you're selling an investment contract. The fourth one is depends solely on the efforts of a promoter or third party. And that's where an MLM company, where somebody's actually working and building their own business and all that sort of stuff, actually doing something to participate, would make it not an investment contract. However, you'll see that this guy, Vin, in his example, said, we'll do all the work for you. So because he said, we'll do all the work for you, that then made him qualify for that fourth prong, which means depends solely on the efforts of a promoter or a third party. So that's when he took his, whatever he was ignorant of, as, or maybe knowledgeable about, either way, of what an investment contract would be, and that's all of a sudden why he gets thrown into the SEC's court, if you will. So anybody can do what I just did. Go do a Howey test, H-O-W-E-Y test, and educate yourself on what you can and can't say, because that little explanation I just gave you is really all you need to realize that a lot of people in network marketing say and do things the wrong way. They actually put themselves, watch their videos, watch what they say from stage, into the stage or into the position of basically putting a bullseye on themselves in the SEC. So, Roger, I'll let you add anything that I just said, and then we'll open it up for David if he has any questions as well.
Yeah, no, it makes total sense. I think that's a very good summary. I couldn't add anything to it, certainly. But, again, to come back to it, it's not only this thing, but if you look at the history of Vima, and that BK Borieko was shut down before Vima, should have learned, and he proceeded in Vima to make exactly the same mistakes all over again, which is really, really surprising. He should have known better, but he didn't.
Right, so that's the purpose of the Building Fortunes Radio platform that I have is, let's imagine that, you know, maybe he knows it all or too arrogant or doesn't have the time or whatever, but if anybody were listening to what we just said, they could probably prevent themselves from being a bullseye for the SEC if they made the adjustments the way they were supposed to do it and did the right work. So this is like elementary school knowledge that people that own companies, surprisingly in our industry, because there's no qualification to be a company owner, there's no qualification to be an MLM distributor. I mean, basically, I mean, if you're an MLM distributor, you're qualified by making sure your payment method goes through. I mean, we don't necessarily want rules and regulations the same way that would stifle, if you will, a regular industry. So my goal is to educate people so they stay themselves out of trouble, and that's why we do this thing on Building Fortunes Radio. I'm going to open this up to see if Dave Ritchie has any example, if he's not in a busy car. David, you can speak as soon as your microphone becomes unmuted, and here you go. David, did you have anything else you wanted to add?
Sure.
On the investment contract side?
Is there too much background noise?
So far, you're fine. I just unmuted you.
Okay. All right. The problem here, your listening audience faces, is that all of these tests are really complicated. In fact, they're so complicated that since Amway 79, the courts have wrestled with the definitions and distinctions, and consumers are just not capable of analyzing that stuff without going to an attorney. and having them look over the plan. So the problem consumers face is that even the FTC says, look to case law to make a decision. Well, I don't know how a reasonable consumer can do that. You know, you have to probably spend more money on an attorney than you have to pay to get into the plan. So I think the answer has to be found in a far simpler distinction between pyramid schemes and MLMs. And that's the direction I'm trying to head.
Right, and I agree that some of the complexities are complex, but the solution is real simple. Meaning, if you're in an MLM, if you sell products to people that aren't part of your compensation plan, like real customers, like any kindergartner could probably understand what I just said, and no offense to kindergartners here, but any kid in elementary school could probably realize that, okay, so I have to sell products? Yeah, hello, like selling's not a bad thing, selling's a wonderful thing. Next thing, I have to do work. I have to do work for not to be a stock. Now, I know, like, for instance, if I call a broker and I say, listen, I want to invest, I want to buy 1,000 shares of stock, I don't have to do the stock. I don't have to go to the factory and make this stuff. You know, I was an investor one time in a company that made this really cool catalytic converter kind of a thing that would save emissions on fuel and all that sort of stuff. It's a great product. It should have been, like, something that made me a bazillionaire a zillion times over. And as an investor, I'm not supposed to also help them sell the thing. Like, I'm just supposed to give them my money, get something back, pay the capital gains tax on it, and I walked away. It was a passive investment, had to be done in an appropriate way with all kinds of levels of disclosures, and the guy who sold me the stock, if it was a common stock like that, had to have some kind of a license, and all of that sort of stuff, and all of that other sort of stuff, and all of that other sort of stuff. So that was a passive investor, but it was done in a professional way. In the MLM world, it's much simpler. You got to sell stuff. You got to sell stuff to people that are a part of the deal, and you have to go to work and build a team. It's not a stock. It's not a stock. And so although, David, I agree with you when we say some of the things are very complex, on the street, the average explanation is just what I gave them. Sell some stuff to people that aren't part of the deal. Build an organization. Do things the right way, and then you'll be fine. What our industry has a tendency of doing was really exemplified in the Banner's broker case. So again, if you go to, I think if you go to Patrick Pretty, the Banner's broker case was explained by a gentleman from the equivalent of the Canadian FTC. So they have a different organization, but it's kind of like the equivalent of our FTC here. And sincerely, he did one of the best explanations of a Ponzi scheme and a pyramid scheme that I've ever seen before. And he explained it, if you just listen in everyday language, to the general public on why Banner's broker people were just arrested. So these things aren't very complex to kind of understand. It's easy to do it the right way, but for some reason, he personally said a lot of people just dress it up. So they dress up something really, really well. Now, here's one of the other challenges. I'm just going to hog the conversation one more time, and I'm going to blend in the Zeke Rewards scenario. Here's the problem. We say go to the attorneys and follow the attorney's advice. Well, that kind of gets thrown out the window if you're Jerry Nira and Richard Wach, because Jerry Nira and Richard Wach, which are really pretty well-respected attorneys in the MLM space, just settled with the receiver for Zeke Rewards, and based on their current knowledge, they admitted that Zeke Rewards was a Ponzi and a pyramid scheme. So now if you're on the other side of the fence, speaking from the Zeke Rewards side, the Zeke Rewards people would probably say, wait a minute, we hired these attorneys to tell us what to do, we followed their instructions, and there's a disconnect here. How can you follow your attorney's instructions, get shut down, have your attorneys later on say, whoops, we just took the money, and yeah, now that we know it's really a Ponzi and a pyramid scheme, it gets really kind of messy as far as that's concerned. So for all those people in MLM, you know, we saw it with Kevin Grimes. We saw it with Howard Kaplan with the Zeke Rewards case, the gentleman who gave the IRS advice to them. And people are going to jail right now based on the information they got following Howard Kaplan's advice. And we still don't know based on whatever, whether he's going to be sued the, or fined for the $100 million the same way the other guys did as well. But it's really getting kind of messy out there of what do you do, who do you trust? And it really all boils down to make sure you're selling a lot of stuff to outside customers. It's probably the biggest thing you could do as far as your stay out of jail card and stay in business card, and then go to work. Build a sales organization. So, Roger, I'll let you tack on anything you want to tack on to anything that I had mentioned.
Yeah, no, and I would say one of the articles that I have liked best over the last few years was one from Professor Bill Black on the Al Jazeera America website in their series on Vima, when one of his articles was Thinking Outside the Pyramid. And at the bottom line, he says, listen, if it's all about the recruiting, run. That's simple. Anybody can understand that. And bottom line, this is kind of what Dave is gunning for, but with his approach of focusing on the recruitment practices that are going on and how that works out. And that's how simple it is. If once you understand that, if the point of the exercise is recruiting, that's the counterpoint to what you just said, with you need to be selling to outsiders. Well, hello, those are two very simple concepts that anybody can understand. But when you get into the intricacies, it's true, and it does say that on the SEC, FTC websites, you know, go, you know, follow case law and stuff like that, which is way over the heads of most people. It gets down to simple stuff. If it's about recruiting, that ain't kosher. You need to be selling stuff to people outside of the organization. That's it. It's supposed to be
yeah,
a sales business.
Yep. That's it. And that's why the that's the thing that tumbled Herbalife on that conference call with David Einhorn when he asked the question, how many retail sales do you actually have?
Yep.
And the gentleman said, you know, I wasn't on the call, but basically the gentleman said something along the line of, we don't really keep track of that. Well, we have no way of keeping track of that. And
that's
for whoever's
exactly
running
right.
the script, yeah, whoever's running the script on conference calls realizes that was not the right answer. That was not the right answer. So even he would have learned if he was listening to Building Fortunes Radio, if we have Building Fortunes Radio. So that's also, I think, why Michael Johnson is usually not doing too many interviews lately, because Michael Johnson has a tendency of being, I'm sure, a nice guy, but putting his foot right in his mouth. So...
Yeah,
he seems like a nice man. I'm sure he does wonderful things, but he gets a little bit emotionally twisted when you kind of get him excited. He says things that he probably shouldn't. Like 90% of our. Go ahead.
Another senior executive, I think, eats more food than Michael Johnson, John DeSimone.
Yeah,
there's two
people that I would.
Stuff that just makes you shake your head.
Yeah, the classic ones that Michael Johnson has said out front in like an opening is that, like, no, we have 90% of our business is customers. And he had to walk that back. And then he said, we make, somebody says, do you provide jobs on an interview? And he said, we provide millions of jobs. And the answer is, no, you don't, Michael. You provide thousands of jobs because there's thousands of people that are employed with Herbalife. They have a big Herbalife's a big company. I think they have 7,500 employees. Employees have jobs. Distributors have businesses. So, no, you don't do millions of jobs. You give people an opportunity to rise or fail in a business. So you provide millions of businesses, maybe, or distributorship kind of businesses, that either succeed or fail. So that's what you provide. You don't provide millions of jobs. So Michael Johnson's a guy that you don't see too much of because I think their attorneys have probably realized that this guy gets us in more hot water than he does. He does more in his sound bites, more harm than he does good. Now, the other interesting
Peter,
thing is Bill Ackman. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to go back just briefly to the test you suggest, and I think it's a great retrospective test. I think what consumers need is a prospective test before they invest the minimum hundreds of dollars that it takes to just get set up. So that's all I wanted to say about it.
There we go. So, Roger, did you want to add or correct anything that I said?
No, I think we're doing fine.
Excellent. Okay, and then the last one, the last thing that I think of as we wrap this up is what's just playfully happened with Bill Ackman. So when I say playfully happening with Bill Ackman, Bill Ackman was on the cover of Forbes magazine for the hedge funds. Like, he was the everybody had a man crush on Bill Ackman because he was doing so much wonderful job with hedge funds in the year 2015, at least prior when Forbes put him on the front cover of a special edition. You know, like, here he is. And then this year, he's been kind of quiet because he hasn't been doing as well. I think his hedge fund is minus maybe even double digits. So you go from the top of the mountain to the bottom of the pile sometimes in a year. And when he was up on the top, he was much more brazen relative to Herbalife. He's been very silent relative to Herbalife. However, behind the scenes, I think both people are still kind of actively, and I know Herbalife is very active because I think they said in their reports they spent about 7.6, and don't hold me to the accuracy of this number, but they spent about $7.6 million on attorney fees handling the investigations that are happening or the legal requirements that are happening relative to whatever he, meaning Bill Ackman and other people, have kind of shaken out. So
and the investigations from the government, you know.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, and that was in a quarter. That was in a quarter. So
yeah,
it's a lot of money. I think we're close to $100 million at the moment. So it's gigantic. You know, Pershing Square, Bill Ackman's fund, computed that they're spending about $500 an hour on lawyers. That's an expensive way to run a business.
Well, that begs
a
question,
and I don't know.
Too.
Go ahead.
That begs a question, too. Why hasn't Herbalife sued Bill Ackman for defamation? They stand to lose a significant portion of any judgment they would gain if they were successful by failing their duty to mitigate damages. And the cost of actually filing that suit, I would argue, are far less than what they're spending on PR and legal eagles to try to prevent an charge being charged.
Right. So I would label. Okay, David.
The only answer I can come up with is they have too much to hide that would be exposed in discovery if they sued.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's even though it's quiet time on the surface, I'd say there's a lot of stuff happening below the surface on every side relative to the Herbalife situation, because why would they be spending that much money on legal stuff? Why would his company have spent as much money? And I think there's probably stuff that, you know, nobody really wants out in the open, because it would be pretty damning information. And if I think, you know, now again, we don't know all the details, but like you, David, if I had a guy coming after me and I was clean, I'd sue the bejeebus off of him. I'd bury him,
oh, yeah.
You know? I'd bury him. But if you got some stuff in your closet, if you got some stuff in your closet, you're in a little bit of a weakened position, so you have to take a different stance. So
I'm sorry, Peter. I don't mean to step on you.
No. You broke up a little bit. So,
what I was going to say is there's another aspect that doesn't get much airtime, and that is that the FBI is also investigating Herbalife. The assumption is that it's related to stock manipulation, but I would suggest that probably not. That investigation has been going on for well over a year, and the FBI only investigates criminal companies. So Herbalife, I think, has a lot more the SEC. I think the DOJ is a wild card that not only extends the investigation, because the burden of proof for a criminal case is far greater than for a civil case. And if I were a stockholder in Herbalife, that's what I'd be most concerned about.
Right. So for those people that are unfamiliar, Herbalife actually helped set a precedent. And, Roger, you're probably going to be able to explain this better than I ever will. but there was one guy that was found guilty of insider training with Herbalife that I think it was overturned, which is going to be really pretty significant relative to what's happening in the state of New York as well. But what happened was there was a guy who was doing some investigation with Bill Ackman who told his roommate about what he was doing. The roommate told a friend who wound up investing in Herbalife stock at exactly the right minute based on that information and made like $47,000 in profit and then try to cancel the transaction as soon as he realized that, oh, crap, I'm going to get in trouble for insider trading. So he went all around and said, no, can't you cancel it? Can't you cancel it? And all the brokers said, no, we can't do that. You're stuck with it, pal. You did it. You know, enjoy yourself. So he was actually, I think the guy went back to Poland or whatever it was, but the government actually started going after people for insider trading based on the tip that someone gave and actually formed a precedent, which was, by the way, overturned, I believe, that is going to crumble a lot of the work that one of the guys in the attorney general over in the state of New York, who has basically been, you know, lauded as being like this wonderful guy that's always a winner. It's just kind of really messy. So it was kind of interesting seeing the high stakes of the stuff that has Herbalife's fingerprints all over it. And Roger, I don't know if you remember the specific frame of reference that I'm making, but you might be able to help clean up whatever I just said.
No, you got your facts right, but then separate from that, Herbalife also at other moments tried to go after like Pershing Square for stock manipulation, and they had this whole trumped-up scenario, but then after a while it was dropped. So, it's been a whole scenario where there's been false accusations flying, and then when you shake them, then they don't hold any water, you know. So, but the insider trading is a very, very dangerous thing, and these professional investment guys are usually extremely aware of it, but it's very often easy to go wrong. If you share information on a private basis as a company, you're not supposed to do that. If you disclose information about your operations, you're supposed to tell it to everybody because you're a public company. There are public investors. You can't give a private investor an advantage over other investors. So that's how simple that gets.
That's it.
I'm not sure about this, guys, but did the FBI have anything to do with that insider trading investigation? I don't think they did. I think that was purely the SEC.
Yes, I don't think so. I think the FBI investigation is purely related to the DOJ investigation of Herbalife itself. I think the other stuff has blown over already.
And when you start using the three letters FBI and then the DOJ, you're not just talking about civil stuff, you're also talking about criminal stuff.
Bingo.
So the price on that one goes way up relative to the price that people pay for the violations. Okay, well, I think we handled most of the important things that are out there on the market, plus a few extras, and I think we're just about done, unless anybody else has anything else they want to cover?
No, I just, as a little surprise, I'd like to say, and you know this basically anyway, but, there is home-based business other than MLM, because I have worked from home many times in my life, but most of the time not MLM. You know, I've dabbled in MLM a few times, but most of the time I've done other business, but often working from home. And then at some point it can get so busy that you need to look for an office and hire people, so who knows.
Right, exactly. And then David?
Just a couple of things. I'm all in favor of successful home-based businesses. I think they're a worthy option in this economy, provided they can be profitable and provided they don't rely on deception. Those are
exactly
the only issues that I have, and I think we all share that.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, I just want to wish you personally, Peter, and I'll talk to Roger again, I'm sure, before the holiday, but I want to wish you a happy holiday and your listeners
Thank
as
you.
Well.
That'll be perfect. Well, thank you very much. Same back to you. All right, guys, we're done with our radio show. We will catch you next time, and we will be back live next year. We'll speak to you soon. Thanks, and bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Building Fortunes Radio Show on buildingfortunesradio.com. Thanks for listening. Check us out every Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for the designated Building Fortunes Radio segment with Peter Meagle. Be sure to check out the buildingfortunesradio.com website for our featured segment. It's been our privilege to have you listen in. At Building Fortunes Radio, we wish you the success you deserve and are willing to work for.